Today is Thursday, March 19th, 2009. I'm Pauline Adams, and I'm interviewing Joyce Grant, Michigan State Professor Emerita. Now, Joyce, tell us about your childhood, things like where you were born, where you grew up, your siblings, your parents, you know, your childhood in general.
I was born in Boston, Massachusetts. I went to public school in Boston, and graduated from a public high school as the president of my class. I liked it because the demographics in the community had changed such that when I became the president, it was kind of like a stunning event, because this was a time when our country was in turmoil, racial turmoil. But I had managed.
When would that be? Exactly.
I graduated in 1956 from high school. And 1960, I was also active in college in 1960. So in Boston was had yet to see its apocalypse, because it was coming in the 70s, 60s, late 60s and 70s. I loved school. I was a kid that was brought up both in the school and in the church. My mother was a churchgoer. My father was a forced churchgoer. But I fell in love with the church and spent all the time that I wasn't in school in the church. And it was a time when schools were rich and robust with activities. When you opened up school yearbooks and you saw that, for example, for myself, I was in the French club, I was in student government, I was in the basketball team. And all this long list of activities that took place in high schools that kids no longer have the opportunity to do. And my father was a welder. He worked in a shipyard. He did atomic welding on the ships, the nuclear ships that they were building in Fall River, Massachusetts. My mother was a banker, and I enjoyed going to the bank. It was her rule that I withdrew my allowance every week from the bank. And so I would go to the bank and withdraw my 50 cents. And I loved that very much. I look back at my childhood with great fondness and sadness, because I miss my parents. My mother died when I was 14 years old. I was in middle school. And I remember her as a woman who was a mentor to other women. When she died, the women that she mentored clustered around me to make sure that I did the right thing. I had all that I needed. The expectations were still maintained that I was going to go to college and all the rest of that. My father, who was a wonderful man himself but didn't know the difference between a trimester and a semester, was a wonderful dad, and I miss him. He taught me how to take care of myself and my home. He was not just a welder, but he also ran a business where he repaired homes and things like that. So I can fix faucets and plumber and do plumbing and all that kind of stuff. I have a basement now full of tools that most people would be amazed at. I went on to college and did a major in French and Spanish.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Boston State College in Boston, Massachusetts, and upon graduation, applied to the Boston Public Schools for a job, but they did not hire blacks as permanent teachers, which was very disappointing.
Was your high school mixed racially?
It was predominantly Jewish. Mm-hmm. We lived in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood in Boston, and as I said, the demographics were beginning to change, so that there were a number of other minorities there, but it was predominantly Jewish. And it was in a Jewish, the high school was in a Jewish neighborhood. And they were wonderful. I have terribly fond memories of my experiences, as I said. When I couldn't get a job in Boston, I went to my bishop of my church. I'm an Episcopalian. And he said he would like me to teach in Cincinnati, in a school in Cincinnati. Well, it turned out to be not Cincinnati, but outside of Cincinnati in a place called Lincoln Heights. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, I ended up living on the grounds of a convent. And as it turns out, it's the Convent of the Transfiguration in Glendale, Ohio. And the daughter of Procter & Gamble, was one of the founders, as I understand it. And it's a magnificent convent with huge grounds, several buildings, and a girls' school, and all kinds of things there. I absolutely loved it. But I taught in Lincoln Heights, which was another one of their schools, which was off the convent grounds. And every morning, I would have breakfast with the nuns, and we would get into the car, and we would drive to school. And at lunchtime, it was a time when lunch was still a break for kids, and they would go home, and I would go upstairs to the in the convent where the school was and have lunch with the nuns. And then we'd go back to school, and then they would drive me home.
So it was a parochial school.
It was a parochial school. It was an Episcopal parochial school. And I loved the experience. Terrified, but loved it. And as disappointed as I was not to be able to teach in Boston, which I had expected to do, I found that it was a wonderful experience to be living there and to be living away from home and to be teaching in this school. And basically on my own, although everyone supported me.
Let me ask you, what drew you to the field of education in the first place? Because clearly, from the very beginning, you wanted to teach.
I did.
Even when you were very young?
I don't remember when I was very young. I think when I was very young, I wanted to be like my mother. My mother played the piano, so I got to take piano lessons. Was terrible at it. And once I said I wanted to do it, she wouldn't let me out of it. So about 7 or 8 years, I struggled through piano lessons. I wanted to go into banking. Why? Because I would go to the bank every week and get my 50 cents. But I also did a lot with children. I spent my summers in free time as a camp counselor. And I spent all my life as a youngster in a camp every summer. And when I was old enough not to camp, to be a camper, I went to New York to another nuns' camp, by the way, another religious camp, and became a counselor. So I was a counselor for 7 years, and then when I was more experienced, I became a unit director at a camp in Connecticut. So, and now when I think of it now, I think of it as a triad. I was a camper. I was a kid who loved school and spent a lot of time in school, and when I wasn't in school, I was at church. So I think that's one of the reasons why I went into teaching. I don't really remember. I don't remember being one of those kids that played with dolls and played school at all. I have no memories of that at all. Mm-hmm. But I got a scholarship when I graduated from college, and because I was the president of my class, the president always got a scholarship, and that was nice. And I went to a teacher's college of education. When I left the Ohio, I went back to Boston and became a substitute teacher in Tewksbury, Massachusetts for 3 years. And one night I was at a civil rights meeting, and the man who was in charge of the civil rights, his name was James Breeden. He was a priest, an Episcopal priest. He was the priests in Boston were very active in the civil rights movement, as they were in the South. He said he was looking for someone to be a secretary and to be his kind of right-hand person and stuff, because the diocese had, at that point, freed him from his parish responsibility to take on this civil rights activity in the city. Boston was becoming a very difficult city to be in terms of racial terms. So I raised my hand and said I would do it. I went to Tewksbury and quit my position. They were very disappointed. Tewksbury was a wonderful experience. I'd been there for 3 years. I was getting tenure. They loved me. I taught French and Spanish in a brand new middle school with this wonderful language lab that I felt like I was an astronaut when I was standing at the front of the room, because it was one of those wrap-around language labs. It was just wonderful, but I decided I wanted to do this other thing. The truth of it was that I typed. I picked.
Two-finger typing.
But I wanted to be active in it. So I was hired for $62 a week. And worked for several years with Jim Breeden and the Mass Freedom Movement, they called it. And it was one of the most, I'm not even sure of the word. Having heard Reverend Lowry this morning on PBS, I don't know the word to express moving, horrifying, exciting, hopeful, despairing time of my life. Because during the 70s, if you were in Boston, every time you turned the news on TV, you saw buses and surrounded by police cars and airplanes overhead protecting first graders and kindergarten children trying to go to school. And you heard of other brutalities of kids, little babies trying to get an education. Because in 1974, a desegregation order came down from the Supreme Court, which said that Boston was guilty of running a dual school system. Well, Boston wasn't the fathers in Boston, the governmental fathers in Boston, as you can imagine, were not happy with that. And that was a time when Boston was then one of the cities that was ordered to bus kids from one neighborhood to the next. And unfortunately, they bused poor kids in Roxbury to poor kids in South Boston, and South Boston kids to Roxbury, and it was a horrible thing. I don't say that it was a bad thing to do busing. Many people at this point, looking back, think it was a mistake. I don't feel that way at all, but it was a horrible experience for the children and for people who were working in that arena at that time. Every day the buses would come back with all the windows broken out, glass all over kids, and you wondered at the fortitude of parents who were willing to put their kids back on the bus the next day to go back out and have it happen again. But anyways, so I spent that time with the Mass Freedom Movement, and I appreciated the fact that Jim Breeden put up with my poor clerical skills, because I was able to do other things that were needed, and I was willing to work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because that's what it was taking to get the work done.
So that took you out of teaching in the classroom.
That's correct. Although we ran, I didn't teach in them, but it helped organize what was then called liberation schools. I don't know if you remember that term, but it was a term that was used for the creation of community schools where minority parents organized schools and sent their kids to schools after school and on weekends for their children to learn and to be involved with meaningful education, because parents felt that their kids were being miseducated in public education. So we had a lot of those schools. It was also a time when parent-run community schools, if you think of Jonathan Kozol, for example, and others, they were also involved in the establishment of parent-run community schools. I later became a principal of the New School for Children in Boston, which was a highly regarded community school. It was a legitimate educational edifice. We had a full house of K to 6 students. We had Jonathan Kozol on the board, and we had folks from all the high and mighty places on the board supporting us, helping to raise money and to keep this school going. And it ran for several years, and other schools were later created, community schools. The thing that was unique about them is that parents were on the board and made decisions as opposed to the politicians.
Let me ask you, from a personal point of view, did you find the move from the classroom to administrative managerial work difficult, exciting, exhilarating? Was it a change you were glad you made?
How did I find it? Yes, I was glad that I made it. I think I am an organizer and an administrator. The bottom line is that's who I really am. Because as I look back on my educational experience, I spent really few years in classrooms in most years as an administrator, either as a superintendent or a director or whatever, because I like to organize. And I'm one of those people that if you think of having a dinner party, I go in my dining room and I back out of the dining room and think to myself, what have I missed? Down to, is the tablecloth straight? Are the napkins right? Is this there? Is the salt spoon there? Is everything right? I like to think in detail. And I like to work with big thinkers. And Jim Breeden was a big thinker. And we really complimented ourselves in that sense. I could run the office and get all that done, even though we have a joke that when I was asked to type something, I would type it and give it to him, and he'd say, well, this word is wrong, and that word is not right, and this word is wrong. And I'd go back, and think of this now. I would retype it, get those words right, and other words wrong. And I would give him a paper. At that time, we used a lot of whiteout, that if you bent the paper would crack. It had so much whiteout on it.
I'm still that way.
Thank God for computers. Anyways, I don't know. I like to it. I enjoy administration. I enjoy organizing and dreaming up things. There's nothing that I've ever done that when I think back on it, that I think, I wish I had added a little of this and some of that and twisted a little of this and done all that.
So you really spent the bulk of your life before you came to Michigan State.
That's right.
In administrative work.
That's correct.
So what made you change when you came here? You came and went into the classroom again, didn't you?
No, I came here to work with the Michigan Partnership for New Education.
Tell me about that.
Well, let me just give you a little background on that. I was invited by Steve Kagan, who was then the president of Outward Bound, to what Outward Bound calls an educators expedition. I'm not sure that's the correct word, but something like that. And Judy Lanier, who was the dean at the Ed School here, was also invited. And Ed Marshall, who was then the Undersecretary of Education, and about eight people who were well-placed educators.
When was this, by the way?
This was in 1989, I think. And at that point, I was then the deputy superintendent for the Boston Public Schools, and I had been invited, and I knew Steve. And we went on this wonderful, I don't know if you know very much about Outward Bound, but it's one of those challenge programs where you put your life in jeopardy. I always tease the board about this. You put your life in jeopardy with every activity they asked you to do, to jump off of this and to climb that and to do all those kinds of things. And Judy was part of this team. And we got to know each other and like each other. Although I can't imagine anyone on a team that wouldn't like each other, given the things they asked us to do. We just clung to each other because that was safety. And shortly after that, in 1990, I think, she sent a headhunter to Boston to get me to come and work in the Michigan Partnership for New Education, which was a major initiative here at Michigan State University to reform education here in Michigan. Well, I was, knee deep or arm deep in being the deputy superintendent in Boston, and I didn't have time to think about that, and I didn't want to come. I said no. A little while later, he came back again. And there were calls, and there were this and that, and so I don't know what the turning point was, but eventually I said yes. I hadn't intended to, because I had a home in Boston, and being a superintendent in Boston is like being a superintendent anywhere. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's all you think about. That's all you really do. And I was not unhappy doing it.
So what made you finally accept
I'm not
the
sure.
offer?
I really don't know.
Even
to this day, because I was not that clear about what the Michigan Partnership was all about. Well, I did come. I came in August of 91 and bought a home and settled in. And I think I came on a Friday, and shortly thereafter, in about a week or so, I was on the job, and I was expected to create professional development schools. And there were, I think, already 8 professional development schools that had been established in the College of Education under the leadership of Judy Lanier, the dean, and the faculty there. I wasn't quite sure what that was all about, so I went and visited and found out what it was all about. And basically, it was a partnership between universities, businesses, and school districts. But it was intended to be a true partnership, not the partnership that you see touted so often, where a business gives money and then disappears. The business or the college was going to participate in a day-to-day, year-by-year relationship, an enduring relationship over time, to make the best schools of excellence that one could find.
So that would include elementary school, middle school, and high school.
That's correct. And they had several schools here that were really very good and well-founded, and we had faculty members in the College of Education who went daily to teach math at the high school, at Holt High School, or whatever high school they might have been associated with. And that was what we were talking about, that the faculty would be part of the school council, that they would teach math 101 5 days a week to Section 5, that they would be integral to the operation of the school. Now, that's a huge commitment, because remember, these faculty also have 3 courses to teach and research to do and community commitment to make. So it was a huge chunk, but it was exciting because there were examples of excellence that they could point to where it was working, where they changed the fundamental structure of schools. One of the high schools, dismissed kids on a Wednesday afternoon, and they spent the rest of the day in teams or groups working to refine what they were doing, to rethink what they were doing, to create new opportunities for kids. It really was a wonderful thing.
And it was confined to Michigan.
It was confined to Michigan.
Let me ask you, did you find much difference? After all, you had very long and intensive experience in Massachusetts educational system. When you came here, did you find much difference between the two systems?
Well, the major difference was the nature of the commitment of the university. One of my experiences in Boston was, when the desegregation order came down, was to coordinate the relationship of Harvard University with a segment of the Boston Public Schools. We didn't have that kind of partnership. And I must say, I worked for Derek Block, who was the president of Harvard. And he gave me every opportunity to have whatever it was that I needed, money or basically a stamp with his name on it that said, if you need this or that, stamp my name on it.
Now,
but not the marriage of someone, of faculty from Harvard, uh-huh, teaching history 507 to Section 6 5 days a week.
Now, I think we should say, just for the record, that you got your doctorate at Harvard.
I did.
Yes.
But I have to commend Harvard for the resource that they made available, but it was not that marriage that we had here in Michigan.
So
it made a difference. I mean, in the summer in Boston or in Cambridge at Harvard, I could get 100 kids jobs. I could get the physicians to go out and examine kids and get their teeth done. And there's so many things that I could do. You could imagine that Harvard has 10 teaching hospitals. So, I mean, they gave me all the money. I went to a meeting with Derek Bach once, and he said, do you need any money? I thought I was going to faint. No one has ever said to me, most people say, I want 10% back.
Has it ever happened again?
Never. So it was a wonderful experience. But coming here, it was a different, it called for a different type of strategy. For example, in order to create the partnership with Detroit, it took me a year. And Deborah McGriff was then the superintendent in Detroit. Now, I happen to know Debbie because she was the superintendent in Cambridge when I was a superintendent in Boston. And we were long friends. But Debbie understood that universities very often offer wonderful things, send their photographers to, and their faculty and administrators to the school to get the pictures, and then are never seen again. And she wasn't going to tolerate that. And she put me through, I can't tell you what, a year to come up with a one-page agreement about what the working relationship would be between the Michigan Partnership and the Detroit Public Schools. It was one page. And we had meetings every week because she did not want a relationship that was going to be something in the wind, where the universities needed to show the public that they were good people so they could keep their tax-free status, and that was what it was. And so we ended up with two professional development schools in Detroit. And I was astounded to go, one was a school, it was the name, it was the White School Elementary School, I can't think of the first name. The school had 1,200 students in it. It was an elementary school with 1,200 students. And we had two professional development schools, and we started the back and forth with the faculty to go to Detroit. Now, that was a difficult thing to do because, again, it was a distance. And faculty had to, you had to find faculty willing to drive an hour to Detroit, spend whatever time necessary there, and then an hour back home. So it was given that I'd had so many opportunities to create partnerships with universities, I really reveled in thinking about how to do this in a different and better way. I knew it wasn't something that you rushed into. I knew, just because I knew some of the principals here, that you didn't go and ask the principal to use the school, and the principal would have said yes and would have been fun, that you needed top-down approval and engagement. And that was going to take time, because Debbie McGriff, when we left her meeting, was not going to think about us again until the next meeting. I mean, she had her, you know, running Detroit schools is like a 48-hour-a-day process. So we did that. In the end, we had 26 or 27 professional development schools. So I created about 20 of them. I also created two charter schools. Toward the end of my stay at the Michigan Partnership, and Judy Lanier had resigned the deanship, and Judy happened also to be the president of the partnership, and Alfred Taubman was a major supporter, if you remember. The focus of the partnership became a little different. It was less educational reform and more of a, under the new leadership, a consultative school relationship, which I wasn't really particularly thrilled with. And one of my tasks under the new leadership was to create charter schools. And I did. I created two charter schools, one in Detroit. One was a parochial school, Catholic parochial school, which later became a charter school. And it was an interesting experience. I was very glad, and I am very glad, to have gone through that entire process of actually conceiving of the process, and how does it work, and I know more about school buildings now than most people because you have to have the building codes and all that kind of stuff, and curriculum and teachers and hiring teachers and aides, and I mean it's starting a school. And I have since thought sometime of starting a school because I know everything about schools. I guess it was about 7 years into my relationship with the partnership, my job at the partnership, that I left. I was not interested in establishing charter schools. I was interested in public education. And it was at that point that I joined the faculty, because part of my original agreement with Judy was that I was an associate professor. I was hired as an associate professor, but I would be loaded off onto the partnership for the time that I was working there. So then I went back to the college and started teaching.
How did it feel to get back in the classroom when you restarted teaching?
Well, it was a little odd at first because although I had had university experience teaching, I taught at North Easton for about 6 years. I taught at Harvard when I was there. I was not a full-fledged tenured professor. And I felt a little lost. I was used to my life being full as an educator. And when I left the partnership, I felt an emptiness because I had no research plan. I was assigned a first semester free time to become familiar with the college and the rest. And I didn't know really what to do with myself. So I found myself becoming engaged with various community agencies and things around here to try to fill up my life.
I noted that when you received the tribute from the state legislature when you retired, it mentioned something about a relationship with the faculty and staff in Nigerian schools.
Well, that's when I was filling up my life. I had an opportunity to travel to Nigeria. I want to say that I have never had an experience where administrators and teachers just yearned for learning. I ran sessions, professional development sessions for the teachers and administrators. And, you know, I can remember in public education around 3 o'clock, people looking at their watches, letting you know that you only have 10 minutes more. And if you want more, you have to negotiate it. I could have stayed for 5 hours. They didn't want me to leave. They wanted to know everything. It was a marvelous experience. And so I created this working relationship with these schools. Now you have to envision this, that the schools, I worked with schools that were in the bush, and what they are these very long, long buildings. And you go into the building and there are like, I don't know, 50, 60, 70, 80 tables, long tables. And there are kids of all sizes and heights sitting around them. And these buildings are in a U shape. And in the middle of the U, the kids go out and play. And, you know, you could go there and teach 2,000 kids at once by yourself because they are so well behaved. They were running nursery schools with like 100 kids because that's all the staff they had. And you would have thought there were like, you know, 10 kids there. It isn't that they were squelched or shy or what, or not kids. It's that they were well disciplined. And the teachers and the administrators were so grateful. I came back home and I had a reception, which was a fundraiser to raise money for them. It wasn't a lot of money. I raised $3,000, but I didn't think I could raise $3, to tell you the truth. Well, you know, and that was a lot of money. That was a lot of money in Nigeria. I mean, a dollar in an American dollar gave you almost a barrel full of what they call what the nairas, I guess, or whatever the money was. And I still have a relationship, and I still owe a debt of going and doing more workshops for them. But I haven't had the opportunity to do that since I left.
What part of Nigeria were you in? I understand it's a very diverse country.
It is. It is. I was in outside of Lagos in a place called Rurimi. And I also stayed with nuns there. I have a host of nun friends, I should tell you, all over the world, as a matter of fact. And their experience there, the community of nuns that I stayed with there, Sacred Heart nuns, these were Roman Catholic nuns, I stayed in what they call a novitiate. And a novitiate is a place where people who just enter the community get their early training. A friend of mine who is a nun here in a community in New Orleans was asked I don't know, it's now about 35 years ago, if she would go to Nigeria and start a indigenous community, religious community, and she did. And when we were there, we were also celebrating the 25th year of that indigenous community. And it's amazing, whereas the churches in America, the traditional churches in America are losing their clergy and their nuns and their religious workers. In Africa, the churches are flourishing. They had over 100 novices. I mean, most novitiates in America, if they're lucky, if they have two or three people a year, or any. And so we stayed. But the thing I want to share with you is that they were doing something different. They had intermingled the tribes. Usually tribes stay within them, their own communities. And my friend, Sister Sylvia, who had created this community, insisted on having a community of intermingled tribes in this religious community. And it caused certain kinds of problems because there were incidents where tribal members would try to break into the novitiate and get the woman out and brought guns and hurt people. So it was a dangerous thing to do, but they did it. And the community is thriving. It's a thriving community. But in terms of their ability to provide educational supports and enrichment for their kids, I want you to envision this huge room I was telling you about with nothing in it. The board, the chalkboard, was corrugated cardboard painted black and a piece of chalk. That's what I used to do my workshop. They have nothing. They have nothing. And it's a situation, again, I've seen it so many times when I traveled in the South or New Orleans or wherever, where being there sets you on fire. You have to do something. You don't know what, but you got to do something. And so that's what created this Nigerian project.
When was that? When were you there exactly?
I was there in 2002.
Oh,
2003.
Relatively recently.
Yeah, 2003. And then some of them came up and, in fact, stayed at my house. Some of the nuns came up and stayed at my house. So I was able to provide them with a lot of materials. I asked people to give me their books, their magazines. I don't care how old they were. They didn't care. And one of the things I learned was you never send anything through the mail to Nigeria, at least. I don't think you send anything to Africa through the mail, because it never gets there, because they break it open and take this stuff. And we had sent this huge box of pencils and crayons and stuff for the kids, and they never got them. So you always have to have an intermediary who is on the way to Africa or coming back from Africa to bring notes or things of that nature, if you want to be assured that what you're sending really gets there. But their gratitude is boundless, and the more you hear them say, oh, thank you so much, oh, thank you, you just feel like terrible that you weren't able to get 10 times more and you couldn't be more available to work with these people, because it's so gratifying, and it's in such contrast to the work in America. I remember Oprah being chastised for saying that when they said, why did you open a school in Africa? And she said, because they asked for education and kids in Chicago asked for sneakers, I think.
Now, but you did work in America, because I know you were involved in New Orleans. Tell us about that experience.
Well, that was another one of those I got to do something kinds of things. And I felt that we as an academic community were confronting the New Orleans situation with seminars on topography and geography and demographics, but not
human.
Yeah, not human interaction. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. I know that there were individuals who did things, and I know that people offered homes. I know that buses were, for example, from Lansing sent down, and they came back with very few people because they didn't want to come up to the cold and things like that. But I felt as an academic community that we were not engaged in a way that I felt we should be engaged. And so I went to an associate provost whom I knew and respected and said I was really upset. Because I remember this so distinctly, being at meetings where we were, when the hurricane and the floods were going on, when I'd be at meetings talking about curriculum and rubrics and whatever else we talked about, and no one mentioned New Orleans. And yet, if we had had a television that we could have turned on in those meeting rooms, we would have seen people clinging to boats and to roofs. I couldn't understand that. It hurt me so deeply. So at some point, I think I just went crazy and I just wanted, I had to do something. So I went and asked June Hewitt if she would see if I could get approval from the provost office. And he was so generous. He allowed me, he provided me the opportunity to go down and see. Well, New Orleans was not a place that you wanted to go down and see. It was a horrible, 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 horrible experience. But I came back really fired up. And I came back and put a slide presentation together. June Hewitt was my co-pilot. And we flew this plane and organized this project and took 62 people to New Orleans. What I liked about it was that 30-odd of the 32 or 34 of the people who went were students who stayed there for that month. And the other 30-odd were faculty members who were willing to come down and cook for us.
Were they good cooks?
They were great cooks. And let me just say that you couldn't go to the corner store and pick up a quart of milk. They had to drive 25, 30 miles one way to go shopping because the whole coast of Louisiana was devastated. And when you drove through the coast to St. Bernard or New Orleans or whatever, Tammany, St. Tammany, you saw houses and streets and cars and trees and houses off their stilts. And St. Bernard, for example, lost every single house. Everything in St. Bernard was totally devastated. I mean, when you drove to St. Bernard, if you turned around in a complete circle, there was no building standing. I don't really enjoy those futuristic movies and things, you know, but it's like one of those movies where you see the guys and, you know, after the Earth is over or whatever, I've forgotten what they call those things. The planet Earth has been, you know, eradicated and you're the last person standing or something. That's what it was like. And then you talk to people. I was talking to a contractor once down there. And we were pointing out, we were able to find an orphanage that had been vacated, and we stayed in the orphanage. And he was looking at some mold or whatever it was on the wall, on the ceiling, and he started to cry. Now, I want to describe, I hate to make this a stereotypic thing, but it was, in a sense. He was a man that wore those orangey boots with the laces wrapped around the ankles and his white socks and his work clothes and his pot belly. And he was a very, very nice man. But we were talking about whether the building was safe for us to be in because of mold, and the man started to cry. I even now, it just tears me up because it was like that. It was like that. Even now, you get these flashes that go across your face every now and then of, I was in a post office where a woman died. And the post office, by the way, was not a post office. It was a warehouse. And you had to get in these long lines and wait and wait in this hot, 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 hot sun to get to the window finally, because that's the way the mail was not delivered. You had to go to this warehouse they had set up and find the right number for your district to get in line and wait to get your mail. Everything was difficult, everything. I worried when I was down that if one of my students or the faculty got sick, there was no hospital. It scared me. It really scared me because I thought we are in serious trouble if something really goes wrong. Because you know that that water, when it dried, was full of feces, dead parts, oil, horrible things. And it was all over the place. You couldn't escape it. It was in the air. So I was really I was not myself when I was working there. I had this I realize now it was like I don't know, I was an automaton doing my mechanical, systematic, detailed, everyday thing up at 6 in the morning. My students left about 6:30, 7 o'clock to go to their various schools all over. We went to 4 parishes, checking the buses. We had rented these we rented 7 vans. We even had a faculty member who was in a wheelchair who came down and stayed with us. The people who participated were simply outstanding. The students and the faculty, I could never thank them enough for what they did and what they put up with. It was not nice. It was not nice. The students who would come back and tell stories of children who, in the course of their lessons or tutoring, would say, "Oh, my uncle and I, we were in the roof. The water was up, and he was holding on, and he slipped, and he drowned. And then we got into a boat," or whatever. No expression on the kid's face. Just horror stories that were, they were numbed. They were numbed.
Did you feel that while you were there, you were numb to all that, and only afterwards could you, in recollection, envision things that sort of just pass through the day?
I'm still, believe it or not, and mind you, I was in a nice, safe house here when that happened, but I'm still going through the tension and fear that I had when I was there because my doing this, and I hate to say this, but I do feel this, was not welcomed by everyone.
Oh.
And I knew that if something went wrong, if I came back with one less person, I was going to be in serious trouble. We were in a very dangerous, we were in the lower Ninth Ward, which was the worst place to be. That's where we stayed, where there was shooting and stuff going on. And here I am with these graduate students who are 20, 25 years old, who want to go out to the French Quarter. And I'm saying 12 o'clock curfew, and they're saying, "What? I'm a grown woman. I'm a grown..." I don't care if you're going. If you want to do that on your own, you can leave the project. I can't be responsible. But it's that fear. It's fear of someone getting sick. The woman who came down in the wheelchair, the faculty member who came in the wheelchair, also brought her aid dog. And the dog was sick twice, and we found a vet. And when the dog got sick, I thought, "Oh, Lord, please don't let anything happen to my people." I was afraid that something would happen to them when they went off away from the orphanage, on the way to their schools or on the way back. I was in constant. I didn't feel this then, but my body was just tight.
When exactly were you there? How long after the hurricane had hit? What year
We went a
and month?
year, we went a year, not quite a year, not quite a year after. And it was, and I had gone down after for the first visit. And when we had put organized the project, there was no difference. And you know about the FEMA business. You know about people living in trailers when they finally got them that were unhealthy. You know about the lack of food, the lack of water, no electricity. If you were out at night, in our district where we stayed in the Ninth Ward, it was pitch black. So I didn't realize until much later when I came back how exhausted I was. Because I was working really 7 days a week, 24 hours a day almost, preparing this. I prepared down to the nth degree. And it went well, and people did their jobs, and I was eternally grateful. But it's like the following year, each day was like an unwinding more for me, not realizing how wound up and taut I had become.
I believe.
And it's, if you went down there today, there is some change, but it's not that much.
Have you been back?
Yes. Thank God for Brad Pitt. Thank God for the generosity of so many people who volunteer down there. But people are still fighting for insurance money. They're paying for places that don't exist anymore. Houses that are gone. Schools were, you know, the New Orleans schools opened, I think, with 7 schools. They had 110 or 15 schools. I mean, it's hardly credible to think about, hardly believable that you could devastate a community that much. And it's not just New Orleans, it's the coast.
Would you say that that is one of your major experiences here at Michigan State, was that New Orleans project that you organized?
I guess I would say that, and it may be because it's the latest thing, maybe because it's most in my mind and still in my heart. It may be, I don't know. There are a lot of things here, but that's the late, that is the one that was the most emotional, I think. That's the most emotional. But I think also, on the other side of that, the joy of doing my technology workshop, the technology grant that we had, working with teachers to bring authentic primary artifacts into their classrooms, having people listen to the real voices, and I enjoy doing workshops to introduce teachers to those ideas, because at first they were kind of ho-hum, ho-hum. And then I would say, now, the New York Times wrote it like this, but this is really what was said. And they would listen. I played a lot of Clinton stuff. And I'll tell you, the New York Times cleaned up a lot of stuff. So they became interested. And so that was the other side. That was equally exhilarating to for myself to learn more about technology and to work with the Chicago Historical Society with the Studs Terkel stuff that we did. To be in his office and to listen to his, Studs Terkel has he could fill this room with the tapes, but the problem is they're all unidentified. You pick up a tape and you don't know what it is.
It's always a surprise.
It's a surprise. So that's the other side.
Yeah. When did you retire officially?
Let's see, I think I'm working in my way into my second year, so what would that be? 2067.
2007.
Yes, 2007.
Now, tell me something that intrigues me. You spent most of your life in Massachusetts, and you still have strong ties to Massachusetts. What made you decide, and I'll say parenthetically that I'm very glad you did, to remain in Michigan?
Oh, that's a good question. But one of the things that I've discovered about retirement is that you have to find a purpose other than these projects. And I'm interested in probably spending 6 months somewhere doing something. I think what I'd like to do is not to, I don't want to be the leader anymore. I would like to kind of go and sweep the floor or shovel some dirt or paint some walls or be told what to do. Someone told me that it's not my nature, that if someone was telling me what to do, I'd tell them how to do it better. But I would like to at least try that for some period of time, somewhere, either here or abroad or something like that. And then spend the rest of the time here. I have things that I'm regularly do with my friends and stuff, so I'd like to do that. But at least for the moment, I'm going to be here in Michigan and traveling back and forth to my other home and trying to figure out how I'm going to finish up this work in New Orleans and Nigeria. I would like to encourage people not to to continue with this technology stuff. I just don't want it to be on the web and for people to accidentally come across it. I mean, the material on the web is really good, and I'd like for people, teachers and administrators, to know about it. So I haven't quite figured out what to do about that yet.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to talk about before I thank you?
Well, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity. I just haven't had a chance to kind of look at my life like the way we've talked about it today. I also wanted to say that I have enjoyed very much being here, and we are neighbors, and I've enjoyed your hospitality many times. And I have enjoyed being on the faculty of the College of Education and made many friends over the university, across the university. And it's an experience I never anticipated or ever imagined. When that headhunter came and said, "We want you to come to East Lansing," I said, "Where?" Never heard of it.
But that's the excitement that life can occasionally offer us.
That's exactly right. And I enjoy every day. I really do. And I look forward to whatever these new mysteries will be that I'm going to be engaged in my life. So I thank you for this opportunity to kind of have this look back.
Great. And I know we are thankful that you had the opportunity.
Thank you.